Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the program. I'm very pleased to have with me today on Talking Books, Rania Afsatni. Just a few words about Mr. Afsatni. He lectures in the Anthropology Division of the University's Mediterranean Institute, mainly on political anthropology of the Mediterranean and the Arab world. And he is currently director at the office that liaises between the European Commission and the Arab League. As I was reminded from the bit of internet research that I did for this interview, he's in much demand as a guest speaker at conferences and seminars, probably because he has that rather rare ability to speak in an erudite and informed fashion without being in the slightest bit boring. However, he's probably best known to listeners for his regular opinion column in the Times newspaper, such as the power of a media presence, and perhaps we shall have a chance to discuss that a little later on. I've known my guest now for many years, so I feel able to say welcome, Rania, to Campus FM and to Talking Books.
Thank you.
I am very happy that you found the time to be with us on this program. When I first suggested that you might participate, I asked you if you would like to talk about a particular book, but your reply was characteristically non-conformist. I could see that you attempted to make me research John Sayle's 18th century translation of the Quran, and while I thank you for not choosing it, being the curious bod that I am, I did look it up and found that it was quite a fascinating story, but perhaps we'll leave that for another time. Instead, you tried to explain to me that your relationship with books is more the reading rat type than the bookworm. What is the distinction really between the two?
Well, the term reading rat isn't entirely my own. The Germans have an expression, Leseratter. And it's the analogue of bookworm, although I've used the term to distinguish it from bookworm. A bookworm is someone who likes books as objects. Likes reading as well, but also likes the feel of a book, as the sort of person who would collect first editions if they could, etc. A reading rat is concerned not so much with a book as an object, but with reading matter. So it doesn't have to be a book. It could be an advertisement, it could be the instructions of skincare lotion, it could be a street sign, it could be a t-shirt logo. And I've always been more of a reading rat. I don't really have any interest in printed books as objects. Notebooks are a different matter.
You say you said in this little note you sent me about what we might discuss. You said, I remember reading the Milo tins instructions or directions or whatever. As a child, though, were you keen on reading like other children sometimes are, or did you restrict yourself to the necessary?
No, the Milo tin wasn't a question of reading the instructions, although eventually I got to there. It was more the title, the picture on the tin, and the fact that I have an older brother. And we used to use Milo tins to make aqualungs.
Where's the connection there? My goodness, sounds awfully dangerous.
No, we used to put the aqualungs into the bath or a sink, so it was quite safe, really. So it was reading as an adventure. The picture on the tin suggested an adventure, and we used to use them to make things. And in a way, for a variety of reasons, reading in order to do something else with what you read has been a continuing theme from my earliest childhood for a variety of influences. With respect to what did I read? Well, at a very young age, I didn't read so much as make jigsaw puzzles, which required, however, reading some things on the picture in order to be able to construct them very quickly, because I used to race. And I used to read car number plates. And the reason behind that had to do with the fact that, as my mother says, I used to sleep at 5 in the afternoon and wake up at 5 in the morning. And the only hope she had to get me to wake up a bit later was to make me sleep a bit later. So she used to walk me out to the Tret al-Barrani. We used to live at Santa Lucia, sit on the wall there, and watch the cars go by. There weren't all that many cars going by in those days. Santa Lucia was a small place. So at first we began by recognizing the cars that belonged to people that we knew, the parish priest, Mr. Attal, Benzina, etc. When that got to be too easy and boring, I had to memorize the number plates. Those were and things I used to read, including the car name on the car itself, so that I would recognize then other people who had the same car. But in terms of reading books per se, as opposed to, for example, records that had, or books that had records with them, it would have been, I think, around the age of 6. I had a birthday party, and one of the presents was an Enid Blyton book, the second famous Five Adventure. It was a hardback. I wasn't at all interested in it. My mother said, "You don't have to read it, just put it on the bedside table." And some time passed. It's difficult to know just how much, because time, it seemed like a very long time afterwards, but I was a child and time passes more slowly. I began to read it at night, and I remember that night very well, because I went down twice from my room downstairs to ask my mother permission if I could continue reading, because it seemed so late and past my bedtime. And I never looked back. I mean, I used to borrow Agatha Christie omnibuses from the school library and read them over the weekend. So, in fact, when in Form 1, our teacher of English made us construct a reading record, some of my friends and I had to lie about the number of pages we read. That is to say, we had to reduce them, because otherwise it would have seemed unrealistic.
Well, I think that sounds fairly normal, in the sense that Enid Blyton, I think, is God bless her, the author that's really made people start to, many people start to read at an early age. But you obviously like the physicality of words, because even when you speak, you obviously enjoy speaking. Not all readers enjoy speaking, but you actually do as well. So you also like the physicality of the word itself.
Yes, that is to say, making the words or the story or the character one's own. That came to me probably most strongly from my grandfather, Erin Seracino Glot, because he was a very good reader of stories. That is to say, he'd read aloud, and he could come over for lunch on a Sunday, and afterwards we'd all gather around him, and he'd read a mystery story, and we'd keep on going. And there were young children and teenagers who had better things to do than to listen to a story, and we'd all listen spellbound. So there was that, and in any case, it was always part of his general philosophy, which he passed on, which is the best way to treat a book is not to treat it reverently, but to make it your own. If you must dislike it not just with passion, but with knowledge. Destroy it. But you must know it well.
Not to be superficial.
Yes, but the idea of not separating passion from the intellect, but combining them so that the passion is a driver of interest, but you're also making the thing your own. which, and until today, I sometimes find myself, if I find a particular passage which I like, to read it out aloud, because that tells me something about its secrets. Something else I learned how to do. For example, with a writer like Georges Simenon, who wrote at an incredibly fast rate. You know, he used to finish a novel of 9 chapters in about a week. But there are some passages, particularly when Maigret is usually sitting having a beer in a square, where you say, how does this work because it's so simple? Well, if you actually use the punctuation to break it up into verse, you will find out that it scans and it's usually in a certain meter. I'm not saying he composed this deliberately.
Okay,
no. It was probably a rhythm that he had internalized because he had an entire ritual in the way he worked, so that the words just came out. And Muriel Spark, another writer I like very much, one of those writers who inspires me to write, is another one of those people. Again, she also was capable of writing very fast, although under highly ritualized circumstances. For example, she wrote by hand, and she would never use a pen or reuse a pen if someone else had touched it. There were a number of other things like that. However, and I don't think this has really been noted even by her critics, at least I've never come across it, you can find in certain of her books, for example in The Public Image, published in 1968, and in The Driver's Seat, that they actually end in hexameters. I don't think it's a coincidence, partly because of what there is in the sentence. That is to say, one of them ends with a clear reference to Aristotle's idea of tragedy, and the other could be a Greek epigram. We also know that she actually used to practice writing those things when she was still an impoverished writer.
Yes, I'm sure there are writers who have little secrets that they don't let on to anybody else within their writing. I'm very interested in the idea of writing as speech, as being spoken, because I was always very interested to. I was very interested to learn that in the early medieval period, the idea of reading to yourself was looked down upon, that you were supposed to actually read out loud. That writing was supposed to be for other people.
And yes, you can even see it. I mean, it is improbable that Saint Augustine, for example, read in any other way except loudly. And you can see that partly because of the way, for example, Latin was written in one single script with no spaces between words. So there it is very difficult actually to read it without enunciating it aloud. Arabic is a bit like that. I mean, there are spaces between words, but generally the vowels are not written in. Now, a practice newspaper reader, I mean, not to talk about even more sophisticated readers, would be able to read a paper without vocalization. But sometimes you actually have to read the entire sentence to discover whether a particular word was this or that. So it's the convention, or rather the practice of reading silently is historically recent. And in any case, most people don't quite practice it purely. They still vocalize inwardly, so much so that the speed reading textbooks teach you how to get rid of that as quickly as possible if you are to speed ahead.
Because it's a waste of time. Mm. And of course, there are certain writers who lend themselves greatly to the spoken expression of their works. I mean, on this program, I've spoken to other people about Dickens. Personally, I do not like reading Dickens to myself. I like to have it read to me. And I actually have heard Emlyn Williams perform parts of Dickens, and there's nothing better. And I wouldn't pick up a Dickens book by choice, but I do love to hear it read out to me.
I wouldn't pick up a Dickens book by choice, nor would I willingly have it read out to me. He's one of those people who I learned deliberately wrote a minor thesis on in order to be able to dislike him with passion and knowledge. But I think there's no doubt that his popularity was partly due to his reading tours, which exhausted him and which he prepared for. Greatly. It was part of his manner of composition. I mean, he was witnessed by his daughter actually to act out a scene in front of the mirror and contort his face and then go quickly to write it down. And no doubt television has been very kind to him.
Yes, of course.
It's television that has really perpetuated his memory. Of course, there'll be all kinds of Dickens scholars who will be
right into the program.
Gibbering fury to hear that. But
well, you've told us about an author you dislike. So tell us about an author who you really, really do like.
Well, I should say that I read very widely and I read in different ways, which is to say I read for my purposes. And I can't distinguish between reading for pleasure and reading for use. Well, obviously, there are people I would dislike and would only read because I have to be thorough on a particular subject. But in most cases, so I might begin to read a book from its end or x-ray it through the table of contents. There are some books I only read just to have a look at the table of contents and nothing else.
Most people find that really shocking.
No, well, you know, I mean, for me, a book or a text is like a telephone. It's there to serve me.
Fair enough.
I don't feel obliged to answer my telephone just because it rings. So there's a variety of purposes, but if there are some writers, you know, I would always go to, and if we're thinking of stories in particular and writers, well, Muriel Spark is someone who I like a lot. Someone who has, I mean, whose style I have studied in order to be able to reproduce on certain things that I write. There's a late Dominican friar, Herbert McCabe, who was a friend of Peter Serracinonglot and who was an external examiner for the philosophy department in the 1970s, who's another such writer. And I will always read anything by Albert Hourani, who was perhaps one of the top three, not perhaps, definitely one of the top three historians of the Middle East in the second half of the 20th century. And by my book, I mean, the top one. They all have something about the style that I wish to imitate, not necessarily copy, but in some way reproduce something about from in their tone of voice or in their attitude in some way, depending on what I'm writing.
Obviously, you have a deep knowledge of Arab affairs. Political and probably literary as well. Do you read books by Arab writers by preference, or do you enjoy that literature, or have you not been attracted to that side of the study of the Arab world?
No, on the contrary, I mean, if there's one thing I learned from, I've been lucky to have some of the best teachers on the Arab world. It is that novelists and writers of fiction and poetry can sometimes capture things that anthropologists and others are struggling to put words to. So, sometimes what novelists write qualify for the statement by someone called Theodor Adorno, who said about Freud and psychoanalysis, all that's true is the exaggerations. But he meant it seriously, and sometimes novelists are a bit like that. But I will always, if a novel comes to hand, I will try to read it. My conversation in Arabic is good enough for me to be able to get by in most parts of the Arab world, especially North Africa, but in a short while with other people. My literary Arabic is nowhere near good enough for me to be able to appreciate a work of literature as such because of its Arabic. I can't say there is an Arab writer that enchants me. Now, that's not a euphemism for saying that I actually dislike it. I'm just saying that what I've read hasn't haunted me in the ways that some other writers does. But I would also not exclude Arab writers who write in a different language, not Arabic, for example, French.
You mentioned this idea of wanting to use what you read in your own writing. You said also to me when we were chatting about this program that what you really, really like is a lovely, elegant, blank page notebook. I can understand that, because I think there is definitely this, a fascination with elegant stationery. And it's not like a book, it's different to a book, but it's a book that there's the potential, there's a potential book. Obviously, you do write. In your work, you write in the newspapers, you do a lot of writing. Would you like also to write novels, or is that not an area that you would like to go into?
One of my crimes or misdemeanors 20 or so years ago, 23 years ago, was to be the editor of a literary magazine at my undergraduate university in the United States. So, my first degree was in English literature. And I actually also published poetry in English. I have a great interest in short literary forms, both verse and the short story, as well as in certain genres of the novel. For example, I'm fascinated by detective stories, which I consider to be almost the contemporary version of the sonnet. I mean, the sonnet is a locked form. I mean, there's only one way you can go into it, and once you're in it, there's only one way you can go out. There's a twist which has to come around the eighth line, etc. And the detective story is like that. Some of the best detective stories are actually less about the crime than about the characters who are pulled together for a short while until the crime is solved. I would be tempted to write a detective story. I don't know if I'll ever have the time, but and there are certain short stories. I mean, there is a genre a subgenre of the short story. I'm not sure it has an official title, but it's the pearl necklace. I mean, every short story or many short story writers from Guy de Maupassant onwards have tried their hand at a story that deals about a pearl necklace, either a theft or a problem with a pearl necklace. And it's a bit like a locked room mystery. Can you write it? There's another kind of subgenre of that interests me a lot, of the short story, which is about a baby. And the thing is, what the great writers do is write their kind of story about a baby. So Graham Greene has a short story in which he finds himself in a carriage on his own with a baby. And the baby, and of course the baby is straight out of Greenland. I mean, he looks like a snob. He almost burps at Graham Greene, and Graham Greene imagines that the burps have this kind of comic bubble in which this guy is talking to him like a toff. Muriel Spark has a different kind of baby story, in which the baby is herself, born at the end of World War One, in which she is digesting the news from the trenches, but in which she is almost like a transmitter of an eerie kind. Donald Barthelme has his version. So, and I wouldn't mind writing
a
baby story.
Yes. We've come to the end of our time. I'd like to say thank you very, very much, Rania Afsatni, for being with us today on Talking Books.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.